This is Jim Fetcher, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is, in my opinion, among the most intelligent and mature, if I may say so, members of the 9/11 research community. She produced a DVD, 9/11 Mysteries, widely regarded as among the best, if not the best, we have in relation to the events at the World Trade Center. And it's a great pleasure to welcome her to the show. Sophia, I'm so glad to have you on.
Jim, you're so complimentary. I just did a DVD for beginners. Please. Yeah.
I got to say, Sophia, it's just stunning to me how few there are out there in the 9/11 community that I regard as adults, and you're a refreshing example of one of those, a very small number.
Well, you didn't hear me go off on a tirade half an hour ago about somebody's spelling and grammar. Alzheimer's, Altimiers.
No.
That's, yeah, Altimiers? Is that like an altimeter? You know? What is it? Is it a... I don't know. I'm not mature about that.
It must be some variation on Alzheimer's.
Well, some people call it old-timers, and they really pronounce it like that, and they...
Old-timers, yeah.
Old-timers, because old-timers get it, you know? But we're not... only going to be old-timers getting this. And I have departed from 9/11 research into a whole new field that encompasses old-timers disease.
Well, you're going to have to tell us more about that. Plus, I understand that your swimming, which I know you have done systematically for years and years, has been disrupted by some odd events out in Southern California. And we want to talk about that, too, of course.
Yes, actually, it hasn't been really disrupted, but I'm aware that what's happening in the sky, this global spraying operation, has got to be affecting marine life. The oceans are cloudy. We don't have anything called visibility anymore. And I'll give you an example. This is about how people's perceptions and their references have changed, okay?
Yeah.
So the other day, I swam. I just got out of the water. I did a long swim, and somebody else had just finished her swim, and she said to me, the visibility is great today. And I said, no, it isn't. And she said, it is. It's great. You can see all the way to the bottom. I said, well, you know something? 20 years ago, you used to be able to make out details on the bottom, and we're only talking 15 feet deep. You could see ripples in the sand. You could see blades of grass. You could see stingrays hanging out, basking in the sunlight. You can't see any of that anymore. You cannot see the bottom. And I told her this, and she said, well, you can tell where the bottom is today. So this is how the perception has changed. If you can tell where the bottom of the ocean is, it's considered great visibility. And I want you to know that yesterday I swam, and there were half a dozen bat rays under me. Now, bat rays are 3 feet wide. They're like winged dragons. They're harmless. They have the basic ray shape, and they are gray in color. I could barely see them, and that tells me they can't see around them, if they even have eyes. I don't know how they sense exactly, but the animals in the ocean cannot navigate because there's so much obscurity, and I believe all this aluminum that they have been raining on us that is whitening our atmosphere with particulate, ionized particulate, this is falling into the ocean. And this is destroying the habitat of millions of creatures.
So there's several points you're making here that are rather important. One is that you've concluded that the chemtrails involve the use of aluminum ionized particulates that are affecting wide areas of the environment, including, of course, the ocean, and obscuring what used to be really clear, pristine water where visibility was excellent, causing it to be cloudy and obfuscating visibility. But also,
yes.
I'm inferring, Sophia, that you have opinions about what's going on here in terms of the why chemtrails are being deployed and these aluminum particulates are being dispersed in the atmosphere.
Well, sure. Fine. I have opinions. I wish I had, you know, more than just opinions. But I just want to make another point about sharks, the great white shark. Typically, they migrate. They're warm-blooded, I learned. I didn't know this. Did you?
I think you asked me that once before. I'm not sure I did or did not, to tell the truth.
Well, sharks are one of the few fish in the ocean that's one of the few species of fish that's warm-blooded. Mm-hmm. And they have no body fat. So their fuel source is in their liver. It's in the form of a certain oil that they make from metabolizing food called squalene. And squalo is the Italian word for shark, so I'm assuming that this comes from the Latin for shark. So they carry the equivalent of the gasoline in our cars. They carry it in their livers. And they have no body fat. So they need to take in thousands of calories. They're enormous creatures. The great whites, you know, attain a length of 21 to 24 feet even. And they weigh as much as 2 tons. So the sharks have now, they migrate from Baja northward over the spring, and they pop in March and April. And we had a fatality here in San Diego County in April at one of our local beaches in very shallow water. And we've never had a fatal shark attack in North County, San Diego. There was one in La Jolla Cove in 1959, but there was no body found. And yet, it is a documented report. The migration of the sharks has changed. I've learned from shark experts that they are hanging around Southern California. They're not returning to Northern California, to the colder waters. And they have begun to hunt for sport. Now, that's very unusual because everything in, you know, nature tends to be very efficient. And we now have sharks hunting, biting seals in half, and not eating them. That means, it could mean any number of things. But they have, I don't know when we'll go for break, but I'll keep talking. They have something in their faces called, faces and snouts called ampullae of Lorenzini, which are electromagnetically sensitive dots, you could call them. And the shark navigates electromagnetically with these sensors. And they are exquisitely sensitive creatures. They can tell the presence of blood in the ocean from a quarter mile away or something, I've heard. So the amount of electromagnetic stuff going on in our ionosphere and these particulates raining down into the ocean has got to be affecting the sharks who live because of their electromagnetic aptitude. Don't you think?
Well, I'm sure. Very interesting. Doing some research while we're talking, it turns out that the sharks, like the great white, they're called mildly homeothermic, meaning they're able to maintain their body temperature above the surrounding water temperature because they have an exchange mechanism that reduces the loss of body heat. It's not quite the same thing as true homeothermy as found as mammals and birds, in which heat is generated, maintained, and regulated by metabolic activity. But it's a very interesting property of sharks.
Yes.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Sophia. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is among the most intelligent and adult members of the 9/11 research community. She produced the DVD, 9/11 Mysteries, which many regard as the best of the best. And it's a pleasure to have you here. Sophia, welcome again to the show.
Thank you, Jim. I think that we can kill it on the intelligent and adult now.
Why is that?
I don't know. It just makes me cringe when I hear this.
Okay. I've just seen, you know, so much childish behavior out there, and I just don't find that with you, and to me it's refreshing. I mean, we have so many factions, you know, in the 9/11 movement, and I think we need to find a way to sort of organize the faction so it's clearly understood that there are groups within the 9/11 community that agree on a large number of issues, in particular in their repudiation and proofs that the government's account is false and indefensible, while disagreeing about various other issues. And The more I think about it, the more I think we need something like that, kind of an umbrella way of thinking of ourselves. And you know, the history of politics reflects many situations in which the existence of factions was simply accepted as a part and parcel. And I think that insofar as the 9/11 research has a political dimension, we probably should adopt that model for ourselves.
Well, again, Jim, I see it as being a grassroots movement. When you look at a meadow of wildflowers, you'll see all different flowers scattered everywhere. It's not like the dandelions are all in one group and the daisies in another and the bluebells in another.
Yeah.
It's that they're all spread out. And however they identify themselves, whether they, and now I'm speaking of the people,
yeah,
whether they're organized or not organized, this is grassroots and the awareness is starting to grow. And as the awareness grows, naturally, the points of interest are going to vary, and new ones will be hatched, and people will take umbrage that so and so is now discussing such and such. You know, I personally believe that something enormous happened at the World Trade Center beyond simple explosives.
Yeah,
and that would make me a space beam, you know, advocate. But I wouldn't call it space beams because, honestly, I don't know what space beams really mean.
Mm-hmm.
This is a term that has been flung at this category of thinking so as to cheapen it, I think.
Yes.
But anyway, to get back to the... And no, this is exactly my point. It's not to get back to. We are not allowed to discuss that kind of manner of destruction at the World Trade Center on 9/11 because it is truly... enormous. It's electromagnetic weaponry. It is stealth weaponry. It's invisible. And this is the form of weaponry that they are now applying to all of us. And I truly believe, it hit me the other night, that if people start discussing that in connection with 9/11, the towers coming down on video, it's so obvious, it's so visible. It's so plain to see them crumble and then to connect that with the kind of means and method being deployed against all of us worldwide, which includes the spraying. It includes behavioral control. This would be too much. Their whole smoke screen would come down because we see electromagnetic weaponry in action at the World Trade Center. If you decide to entertain the idea that something beyond mere explosives were used.
Yes.
Right? And they cannot allow us publicly to make that connection. They cannot allow us to discuss the kind of weaponry being used against us in a widespread way. Today, there is a gigantic covert operation in play against human beings, which is electromagnetic in nature.
Yes.
And it's affecting everything. I believe it's affecting marine life. It's very possible that the fires in Northern California were generated by lightning strikes, which were generated by HARP. The air is conditioned. It's now a conductive plasma. It's no longer neutral. Thanks to the amount of particulate, the saturation that it holds, that it is. It is saturated now with this stuff. And that was the basis for which this engineered crisis, this disaster, forest fires. You know, somebody just told me that he was fighting fires in Northern California himself, struggling with the hoses, and the firefighters were sitting there on their butts watching him.
What?
They did nothing.
Why in God's name was that happening?
Because he told me they are instructed to let it burn. Let it burn. They're not meant to fight.
Well, I've heard of there are occasions when forest fires and so forth are allowed to burn themselves out.
Well, that's right. That's when you meet it on the other side with a fire. You start a fire and the two fires meet. I forget what it's called. But anyway, that's one method of fire control. But in this case, this guy was not able single-handedly to put out a fire. He told me it resulted in $2 million worth of damage, and the firefighters sat around and watched him, and then they went home. They left him by himself. So none of that makes any sense. Arnold Schwarzenegger had just told the state of California that the fire season was normally 3 months, but now, guess what? Now it's all year. Now our fire seasons are year long, which allows them to engineer more disasters, which is state-sponsored weather terrorism for control of our lives. And this is all possible because of the electromagnetic preparation they have done in the ionosphere and the atmosphere. Now all they have to do is throw the switch. The air is conductive. We are conductive. These particles are in us. The sharks are sensing them. Maybe that's why they're not going back to Northern California, because of the HARP that was, set off there, the HARP activity. I have no idea. And I was talking to a shark researcher recently, and he said it would be very interesting to start looking at the way in which animals are affected by government experimentation. And you know what? It occurred to me, well, maybe then the population will care, because it's now affecting a marine creature. And they have this love for the oceans, but they don't have it for humanity itself, you know? Save the dolphins, but don't save the Iraqis.
Placing greater value, yes. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest, Sophia. We'll be right back. My special guest today, we got a bit of a buzz here. Let's hope it'll disappear. Is Sophia, who has produced one of the best, if not the best, DVDs in 9/11 history, 9/11 Mysteries. Sophia, it's just a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Yes, and as I said, I am now understanding that 9/11 was a covert operation, and we have a continual covert operation that is affecting all life forms right now, which is this engineering of the atmosphere and ionosphere through electromagnetic means. And we were talking about sharks earlier and marine life and the planet, and I ended with a bit of a rant. Now you can see that, you know, I'm not as even and contained as people think. But yes, we have issues here with every life form on this planet. And how do you get people interested? They're clearly not interested in other people. They're barely aware of themselves being affected by this.
And, you know, the people who are making decisions about things like this have so little education or knowledge about evolution and ecology. I'll never forget a conversation I had with Doug Rocky, who has had experience, great experience in the military, using many kinds of weapons. He was a B-52 bomber pilot in Vietnam, for example, and he was talking about the use of depleted uranium weapons in Iraq. And I was explaining that, of course, as you know well, it's causing contamination in vast areas of that country. It's being blown around the Middle East. It can spread worldwide eventually. It's radioactive and has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, which is equal to the scientific estimate of the age of the Earth. So there's no telling. You know, there are massive genetic defects that are showing up now in offspring being born in Iraq, and its consequences are absolutely terrible and potentially of very long lasting effect. So I'm terribly, terribly troubled by this. And I said to him, Doug, how can you use a weapon like this when it has such devastating consequences? And he said, because it's effective, because it's the best weapon, meaning when you fire one of these depleted uranium weapons shells, because they're so dense, they go right through the armor plating of the heaviest tanks and destroy them. But, you know, to me, that's obviously, it's no excuse to use a weapon that's inhumane to its core.
But, Jim, it's all deliberate. The destruction, the byproducts of depleted uranium are the whole point of this, that you're blowing something lethal that's going to interfere with the genome of all living things, that's going to alter the viability of life. And that's the war. The war isn't the people shooting and knocking each other down. That's just the theater. But the real war is the elimination of life. and then ultimately the control of whatever is left, the engineered control.
And when you mention the elimination of life, you really mean reducing the population of human beings on the planet Earth.
Yes, but the elimination of nature. You see, nature is a pain in the butt because it's variable, and you never know what it's going to do. It's going to create this strain or that one, and they don't want this. They want engineered forms that they can control. They don't need bees. They don't need butterflies. They don't need songbirds. They don't need any of this. Why is Bill Gates and his friends at Syngenta and the Rockefellers, why are they making a seed vault in the Arctic to house 4.5 million seed varieties for the future of the Earth? What do they know about the future of the Earth that we don't know? Why are they doing this? Because they want the basis from which to create growing life forms. They don't want the wind and the butterflies and the bees to be the...
Yeah, this is fascinating. The fact of the matter is they don't know enough to know how to do it right. I mean, nature is such a complicated causal process in terms of evolution, et cetera, that for them to think that they could take current knowledge, for example, and be able to anticipate the course of events if they were to try to reconstruct what nature has done over countless millennia is a guaranteed recipe for disaster, Sophia.
Well, you're still thinking in a very old-fashioned way. They're not trying to redo nature. They're trying to do something else. They're trying to eliminate nature. They want to sidestep it altogether.
But of course, that's impossible. I mean, we're talking about all the laws that hold the world together, all the laws of physics, chemistry, biology, psychology. You can't redo those. Those are not changeable. They aren't variable.
Well, those can be damaged badly, and then you have chaos that ensues, and they benefit from chaos. The chaos actually helps their program along. Their program is simply to take out a few things from the chaos and then control those things.
But you see, the systems they're talking about are so complicated that they don't understand that they can even be chaotic in the technical sense, meaning that the least change in one part of the system can have enormous consequences for the system as a whole. I mean, they don't understand the science. They don't understand the philosophy. They're creating a recipe for disaster. I mean, they may think they're going to make a better world. What they're actually doing, I would predict, is destroying it.
That's the point. They're not trying to make a better world. They're trying to take over the world.
I mean destroy all life, including their
own, right.
Sophia. I'm not just talking about, you know, they think they can manage these things. They can't manage these things. I mean, you know, once you get all that depleted uranium out there, who's to know who it's going to affect? It's been measured in London, for example, in other European countries. It's spreading to the North Africa. It's going to make its way into India and Pakistan without any doubt. It's a calamity. And you take bees out. Bees are responsible for pollination in relation to many types of foods we like tremendously, like different kinds of nuts and apples and things like that. I mean, these are going to just, if you don't have bees, you're not going to have those things.
No,
those kinds of food are just going to disappear. I've heard the estimate that there have been in the past something like 139 different kinds of corn. I don't know if you were mentioning this to me. And that Monsanto is seeking to reduce it to something like 4. Well, this is absurd. This is quite absurd and an awful situation to contemplate.
Well, that's right. But that's what they're trying to do, is bring it all down, put it through the narrowest little pipette, and put their little drops of creation on the earth, and that will be it. That will be life. It'll be all nano-engineered. Instead of cell biology, we're looking forward to a future of nano physiology, nano engineering, nanobiology. This is the whole new horizon.
Well, the problem is, unless you're truly omniscient, you can't anticipate with sufficient reliability the consequences. Once you disrupt a single level in the food chain, you have destined for extinction all species at higher levels on the food chain. And
That's
it appears
it.
To me that this is taking place in the world today.
That's exactly it. You're seeing it, Jim. You're seeing what they're doing.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Sophia. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, we're now concluding a conversation with Sophia, who is the producer of 9/11 Mysteries, one of the best, if not the best, DVDs in the history of the 9/11 truth movement. Sophia, you're really sketching a very gloomy picture here of the where we are, and I'm sorry to say I know no reason to argue against what you're having to say.
That's right. It sounds gloomy, but Jim, you know, I do believe that we have some utilities at our disposal that are the equivalent of this electromagnetic stuff, which is the magical consciousness abilities that human beings have that the mystics have written about. And, you know, occasionally a mother picks her VW up off her trapped child, this kind of thing. And we're going to have to, I don't know how to evoke this in ourselves, but this is our only way out. On the physical level, we can't investigate and scold them and tell them to stop and tell them to bring the bees back, because we'd rather have pollination going on naturally than the way they want to do it. It's not going to work. They have been planning this. There's something very, very perverse in this plan. And it doesn't originate from people like you and me and our, you know, friends, and no matter whether they're 9/11 people in agreement with us or not. This is something completely different. This is a different kind of orientation to and around and about this planet. I don't know what it is, but there are things in store for us, I believe, that we're going to be absolutely shocked by that we have no knowledge of. And it stuns me that the 9/11 movement will not discuss effects and possibilities in an open way, in a theoretical way.
Yeah.
That absolutely could have been involved. Because you know what? Our knowledge, the lay person's knowledge, even the knowledge of people in science labs in various universities.
Yeah.
This is all plebeian. It's not,
yeah,
it's not advanced.
There's a bizarre kind of premature closure that's taken place in the 9/11 community, as though they knew enough and didn't want to know anymore and were even afraid to discuss it. I mean, the turning 9/11 blogger into a closed shop for 9/11 orthodoxy is an absurdity.
That's right.
Not only was I given the boot just for having a blog there in which I discussed my reasons why I thought Steve Jones' work was not all and the be-all, but even someone as moderate as Kevin Barrett has been booted off a blogger. I say, if you're taking people like me and Kevin off a blogger, I can't see that it has much purpose other than to, you know, be an exchange of platitudes among the true believers in certain views that may not be ultimately justified.
Jim, it is very possible that they allow the controlled demolition explosive theory of 9/11 to come out. And they will blame it on the current administration, who are on their way out in a few months, and they will never allow a bigger discussion of what happened at the Twin Towers. And let them throw in Building 7, because it is too directly revealing of what they are doing and what they continue to do. So this controlled demolition is old-fashioned. We had bombs back in the 40s, you know. There are other things. They started with whatever is weapons, sticks and stones, then we went to knives and swords, and then we had gunpowder, and then we had bombs, and then we had chemical weapons, and then we had nuclear fission. And now we have electromagnetic stealth weaponry, biological weaponry. All of this is invisible, and they don't want us to be talking about what's invisible.
Well, I sure agree with your fundamental point, which is that, you know, it's like the CIA. What they fear most is not the exposure of an operation, but the methods, the means they use when they conduct their business. It's like the military here. What they don't want revealed were the means or the methods that were used to bring about the destruction of the Twin Towers, especially.
Right. I mean, I think Stephen Jones' work is fine, but Are we not allowed to talk about anything else? Can't we suppose? Can't we theorize? Can't we do the what if? Do you know that what if is it's the basis on which inventions are made?
The four stages of scientific inquiry, puzzlement, speculation, adaptation, explanation. Speculation is the crucial stage. If you can't get all different alternative hypotheses out there articulated for discussion, you may never figure out what's the true, because you prematurely fixate on some small number and exclude all the rest, which may include the true hypothesis.
Right. Now, I want to point out that we've discovered that there's a whole body of incorrect information that is being peddled by so-called scientific sources about contrails. There is this term, persistent jet contrails, which is, it doesn't exist. It's an impossibility. A contrail is like your breath on a winter day. It forms, it disappears. You breathe out more, it forms, it disappears. Your breath could not expand and make cloudy masses around you as you walked. That's unheard of. So the contrail expanding into this artificial polymer cloud cover with metal particulate in it, this is not a contrail. And yet there's this enormous body of science out there that says that under certain very humid conditions, contrails can spread. It's total rubbish.
This is an attempt to make it appear as though the contrails are actually harmless.
Yes.
And easily explained, right? You know, it's typical of the disinformation operations that their attempt isn't actually to persuade you of the truth or falsity of one position or another. In the case of 9/11, not trying to convince you of the truth of the government's position, for example, but trying to create enough uncertainty that everything is believable and nothing is knowable. That's why the scientific grounding of our reasoning in relation to our inquiries is so absolutely crucial.
That's a very good point that you just made, that everything is believable but nothing is knowable. That's very interesting. Isn't that what you just said?
Yes, it is. I didn't originate it. Martin Schultz, who published a book entitled History Will Not Absolve Us, is a psychiatrist who resides in the Boston area, and he made that observation in relation to disinformation relative to JFK. But it's an astute observation and absolutely crucial to understand disinformation.
Well, amazingly, I have that book right here, History Will Not Absolve Us, so that's going to be the next thing I read. Yes, can you believe it?
That's terrific.
Hold it out. Yeah, no, it is important that we open our minds, that we think outside the box. We cannot just be in the box and believe what we're being told, even though it can be found on this website or that website, and these are all authority websites. We have to become our own authority. We have to do our own work to the best that we can, the best of our abilities, and share the ideas in a very open way.
Yeah.
You know what? I've come to believe that almost anything is possible, except those things that absolutely defy the laws of physics, like and nature, like the contrails cannot form, like your breath cannot expand. Contrails cannot form and last all day long. Those are not contrails.
Yeah.
Can be called contrails.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah. In my philosophical work, I've distinguished three different types of possibility and impossibility. The logical impossibilities, you know, you can't have someone who's both a bachelor and married, insofar as bachelor implies being unmarried. You can't have someone who's a freshman but not a student. You can't have a Volkswagen that isn't a car. These are all things that are, you know, necessarily true by definition. So that's one class. But the more important class to which you're alluding really are the laws of nature, which can't be violated and can't be changed. And we're talking about laws of physics, chemistry, biology, and so forth. And these are profoundly important to understand the way the world operates, because this is the kind of glue that holds the world together. The third are the historical impossibilities, which have to do with not being able to undo history insofar as it has occurred up to a certain time T. But there you have to, of course, figure out, as you do indeed in terms of logical and physical impossibilities, what the actual history of the world has been up until that time. But it's like to say today, you couldn't be the first person to climb Mount Everest today, because Sir Edmund Hillary did it a long time ago.
Right.
So, Sophia, I want to thank you for coming on. I look forward to having you back, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join me.
Well, thank you, and you just delivered a most wonderful conclusion to everything that we discussed, so thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate your being here, and keep up the good work, okay?
Yes.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. I'll be right back after this break. Having concluded my conversation with Sophia, I'm going to discuss a variety of issues related mostly to domestic politics, but some 9/11 research and the 9/11 community. I think Sophia was exactly right when she suggested that there's too much infighting. It seems to go on in really rather vicious, if petty, ways, some of which have been extremely distressing to me as a philosopher, particularly a philosopher of science, someone who has studied the history of science and the philosophy of science and understands that science is our most reliable method for determining what is the truth, but that it must be applied in the appropriate systematic fashion, that it requires basing our reasoning on all of the available evidence. That's known technically as the requirement of total evidence, and where violations of that requirement are known as special pleading, you only cite evidence favorable to your side, also known as the method of selection and elimination. Select the evidence that supports your side and eliminate the rest. We well know this in political context because it's the method that George Bush and Dick Cheney have systematically used to bias the case for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which had completely independent motivation. Really, they had to do with oil Israel and ideology, the idea of creating an American empire, but they knew that none of those motives were saleable to the American people. So as Paul Wolfowitz blurted out in a moment of excessive candor, they settled on weapons of mass destruction as the most marketable way to induce the American people to support these ill-conceived missions, which are, of course, turning out to be interminable and vast squandering of resources and deaths of thousands and thousands of Americans, but tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of Iraqis, and where we don't even keep count. But they're human beings just as much as we are, and they have a far more ancient civilization that stretches back over 5,000 years. But in our ignorance of history, we tend to disregard the fact that other countries may have had far more ancient legacies and made vastly more contributions to the world civilization than has the United States of America, which is a relative newcomer at around 250 years of its endurance. It's, to me, completely stunning how these things happen. But in scientific reasoning, you see, this is the sort of thing that defense attorneys and editorial writers frequently, and politicians, of course, do, is to offer only the evidence that favors their side. Thus, the Downing Street memo revealed that Bush had already decided to invade Iraq. In fact, we know from Paul O'Neill, the first Secretary of Treasury, that at the very first cabinet meeting, Bush was already talking about attacking Iraq, and this was long before the events of 9/11. So it's all been, fixing the, having the objective and then fixing the intelligence around it. It's disgusting and goes on to this day, as I'm going to explain. But the fact of the matter is, if we're trying to figure out what happened on 9/11, we got to consider the full range of hypotheses. I mean, theoretically, you even want to consider whether there could have been natural causes that were responsible for the events of 9/11 in New York, the destruction of the World Trade Center, hurricanes, typhoons, cyclones, what have you, tornadoes. I mean, it's obvious they aren't among the causes because the probability of the effects, which were so selective in taking out roughly all and only buildings with WTC designation, is not the kind of outcome that we would expect from any natural cause. It would be far more varied in its effects and less focused and systematic. But this just shows that what you have to do when you adapt the hypotheses to the evidence is consider what is the probability of the effects that we actually observe if the hypothesis were true. on the hypothesis that it was, say, a tornado that brought about these effects, then we expect kind of a tornado-like meandering path of destruction through the city, just as we see in little towns and villages and cities in the Midwest when they're struck with tornadoes, not the very selective devastation that took place where the Twin Towers, for example, are turned into dust from the top down and disappear at about the speed of a free fall, and yet there's nothing left when it's all said and done. There's no stack of pancakes. There's just millions of cubic yards of very fine dust and millions of pieces of paper. I'm going to return to that. Millions of pieces of paper. I mean, there were just tons, literally tons of paper distributed throughout the city. And that seems to me to be an awfully important piece of evidence that some on one side of this debate are unable to account for. Okay, if we go beyond, of course, then we have the official government account of 19 Islamic fundamentalists hijacking four aircraft, flying the planes into the buildings, the jet fuel-based fires, and we know everything wrong with that. We know most of the jet fuel burned up in the first 10 or 15 seconds, that we had roughly ordinary office fires. We have 236 samples of steel studied by NIST, which determined that 233 had not been exposed to temperatures above 500 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas the melting point of steel is closer to 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. We know that the other three samples hadn't been exposed to temperatures above 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. So the whole official government story is a non-starter. In fact, there's no reason to even think that there was serious damage to the core columns from the planes, assuming they're real and not some kind of illusion. I mean, even if we take the official government account at face value, it's an incoherent account because its features contradict laws of physics and of engineering. The fires didn't burn long enough or hot enough to cause the steel to weaken, much less melt. We know from Underwriters Laboratory they certified the steel to 2,000 degrees for 3 to 4 hours at 2,000 degrees without enduring any ill effects. Well, these fires burned only about an hour in the South Tower, an hour and a half in the North at much more modest temperatures. Even if you had all the jet fuel in the world, by the way, it wouldn't burn any hotter just by virtue of its quantity. So that there's a, you know, psychological tricks are being played all the time. Elementary fallacies are being committed to try to induce us to believe that because there was so much jet fuel, therefore it must have, you know, burned hotter than jet fuel can burn. But that's not the way it works. In fact, under ideal conditions, you could have jet fuel burn as hot as 1,800 degrees when it's fed pure oxygen, but that's still 1,000 degrees away from the melting point of steel. And it didn't happen long enough. I mean, you know, steel is a very good conductor, so even if you heat up a part of it, that heat is transferred throughout the entire structure. So basically, you'd have to be heating up massive quantities of these 500,000-ton buildings, and it just didn't happen. So the whole government count is easily refuted. Okay, then what does that leave us with? Presumably various categories of controlled demolition. In other words, this was done deliberately. It was a deliberate demolition. But don't let the language induce you to suppose, therefore, it had to be, say, a classic controlled demolition of the kind that we observe at Building 7. Building 7, we see the explosions going from the bottom up, blowing out certain key support columns. The whole building comes down together, all the floors moving together. When it's all said and done, we have a stack of pancakes five floors high. This is not what happened to the Twin Towers, as we all know. Stand by. The first hour featured my special guest, Sophia. Today I'm talking about issues related to 9/11 research in the community and then some domestic political issues during the second hour. I was just mentioning Building 7 came down in a classic controlled demolition. The explosions began at the bottom, taking out key support columns. That's why you have that little peak there, a little ways in at the top, because that key support column has been taken out, so the building will tend to fall inward onto itself rather than outward into its own footprint or foundation. About the speed of free fall. All the floors are moving at the same time. When it's done, you got a stack of pancakes, okay, about five floors high. That's just what you'd expect from a classic controlled demolition. Now, that was a 47-story building. If you look at the World Trade Center, they're more than twice as tall. So if you had, like, five floors, And I think it should be like something like 12.5% to 14% of the height should be preserved, say 12%. Then you should have, you know, about 14 floors maybe for each of them. And that's not true. In fact, I had Father Frank Morales on the show, and he explained to me they were actually reduced to pits below ground level. But let's call it ground level. There were no pancakes. Jesse Ventura was there 2 days later. He said no pancakes. He's made some of these points really simply. He said how three buildings with two planes, no pancakes, and how his propane stove burns hotter than kerosene. And it doesn't melt when he turns it on, but of course, if the government's account were true, that would have to happen. So we see the absurdity of it. Now, if there's a fundamental flaw in Orthodox 9/11 research dating from David Ray Griffin even, it's the assumption that Building 7 and the Twin Towers were destroyed in the same way. That's manifestly not the case. And anyone who can honestly look at the footage of the Twin Towers being destroyed, turned into very fine dust, from the top down, all the floors patiently waiting their turn to be blown to kingdom come, in Morgan Reynolds' memorable phrase, okay, knows these are two completely different methods of demolition. They can still be called controlled demolition because it's the controlled or deliberate destruction of these structures, but they're done in completely different ways. As I say, Building 7, classic controlled demolition. Buildings 1 and 2, completely different. And therefore, I argue this is some kind of unconventional controlled demolition. It required some kind of weaponry that went beyond what was used on Building 7. If they used dynamite or RDX or thermite or thermate in Building 7, then they may have used some of that in Buildings 1 and 2, but that can't be the whole story because the effects are completely different. And here's something I want to put to those who think that they can explain all this with conventional explosives. Conventional explosives create great fire and heat and would burn paper. And yet we've got tons of paper all over the city. If those buildings were destroyed using controlled demolition, a classic controlled demolition with explosives of the kind that Stephen Jones, Kevin Ryan, that whole gang wants to insist was the case, then how is it, how can it happen that we have tons of paper that was not destroyed? You got all this very fine dust and tons of paper. It's everywhere. I've been looking at some photographs lately, just exhibit how much there was. It was massive. So if you got a mode of demolition that primarily involves intense heat and fire, it's going to burn all that paper. It's not going to be selective. So I say something is completely wrong with Orthodox research in 9/11 that insists that Building 7 and 1 and 2 were brought down the same way when they manifestly were not. And the idea that it could have been a classic controlled demolition on 1 and 2 is, when you look at the evidence, frankly absurd. It's so grossly wrong, I can't believe anyone continues to take it seriously. And how can you account for the fact that there is no stack of pancakes, that the buildings are turned into millions of cubic yards of dust, and the paper survives? Plus, of course, the other fault I lodge against Orthodox research is the claim of flowing molten metal, supposedly from the little waterfall from the 80th floor. Well, that's ridiculous. If that's supposed to be from thermite or thermate, then since it was used throughout the whole building, by hypothesis, you should have those little waterfalls all over the place. They should be randomly distributed all over these 110-story buildings. There's one location. Just happens to be a location coincidental with a Fuji Bank building having this battery of batteries there, a whole array of batteries there as backup energy source in case the computers went out so they could guard the information for all their clients. So there's something peculiar about that location that led to that little waterfall, if it's even authentic, because I have photographs, some show it coming out of the third division of windows and some the fourth. But it's manifestly nothing of great significance. It's certainly, in my opinion, no evidence of thermite or thermate because it would have to be everywhere. If it's really thermite, thermate, it should be distributed randomly throughout these structures. Is no one thinking about this? Is no one thinking about this? So if you're going to artificially constrain the range of hypotheses to explain this, cut out nukes, mini nukes, third generation, fourth generation, even if you don't know that they got, you know, many different kinds that have been affected for demolition purposes as long ago as the Eisenhower administration. They had nuclear weapons that were designed for the purpose of demolition. Suppose we could rule those out. You get a claim on that basis. It had to be conventional using RDX and thermite and thermate. This is absurd. The properties, the effects, the gross effects aren't remotely consistent with that hypothesis. So we've got to consider, if we want to figure out the truth, how it was done. Now, there's another group, of course, championed by Judy Wood, who has been promoting the research that suggests it was some kind of directed energy weapon. Now, Judy is so tentative about how it was actually done, that's about as far as she goes in describing it. I, for specificity, add that it could have been lasers, masers, maybe plasmoids. Something very sophisticated was going on here. If there was some way to use HARP, Judy is now suggesting the source of energy. This is my interpretation of her, what she is talking about, that there was a hurricane off the coast of New York that was never reported to the American people on 9/11. This is bizarre. A hurricane could theoretically be used as a source of energy that might have been expended in the demolition of the Twin Towers if you could figure out how to transform it in the constructive, directed fashion. Well, I think that's a fascinating hypothesis, but most of you out there have never even heard it before. Why? Because 9/11 blogger, for example, kick me off its site just when I had a blog there. I mean, it's a blogger, right? You're supposed to have blogs. I had a blog there, and I was raising questions about Steve Jones' research and why I think focusing on this little tiny sample of dust is ridiculous. We don't know exactly where it came from. We don't know exactly its source. We don't know when it arrived in that apartment. I mean, they try to make these absurd arguments. I mean, you need hundreds of samples of dust from all different altitudes, locations. Steve Jones hasn't done that. I'll never forget the American Scholars Conference, how he holds up this little teeny tiny, says, this is enough. Well, it isn't enough. And I've explained why it isn't enough in a lot of different places, but no one wants to listen. If you arbitrarily can track the range of hypotheses, you may never discover the truth. So that what blogger and the other, you know, imposers of the orthodoxy, and, you know, their names are familiar, are really doing a disservice to truth. If you care about truth about 9/11, you've got to abandon this commitment to orthodoxy, especially when it's demonstrably indefensible. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest the first hour was Sophia. This hour I'm talking a bit about the 9/11 research community, what goes on inside in domestic politics, and I just want to say a few more words about 9/11 before I turn to what's going on here politically in the United States. I think there's a way to cope with this, which is try to share information, evidence. Judy's very patient and painstaking about exploring evidence in a massive photo gallery she has amassed over time that is utterly fascinating. It's all beautifully documented. When she gave a presentation of several hours at the conference on the science and politics of 9/11 here in Madison last August. And I want to encourage everyone out there listening to me to go to 911scholars.org and order, say, just one copy of that DVD. It's $20 for 14 hours of some of the best research presentations you'll ever see, and send it to somebody who needs to look at this stuff, because there are too many closed minds out there who aren't coming to grips with the evidence. You have simply to look at the evidence to understand these orthodoxies I'm addressing are really indefensible, and that means those out there who are enforcing orthodoxy. And they range from, say, people like Reprehensor and John Gould at Blogger and Arabesque, and descend to persons who are vicious and cutthroat like Colonel Jenny Sparks and Victronix. Those of you who are active in the community know of whom I speak. Undertake this the subversive act of sharing information, evidence, because there's wonderful stuff in 14 hours for only $20. Let me encourage you to do that. If you know somebody who needs to know more about 9/11, believe me, this is a perfect place to go, because it's more advanced in terms of the presentations made than you will find from any other source. I mean, I love Sophia's 9/11 DVD, 9/11 Mysteries, but you need this to bring yourself current with the state of research today. It even includes a woman with a PhD in theoretical physics who at the end of the conference, when I invited participants to offer their opinions, explained how, after seeing Judy's work, she realized something she hadn't realized before, that this appeared to her had to have been done using masers. Listen to her explain it. Think about it. Being closed-minded is unscientific, it's authoritarian, and it actually promotes the perps. It helps the bad guys here, because until we figure out how this was actually done, the more we run ourselves up blind alleys and ignore relevant evidence, the less likely we are to discover the truth. And if we don't discover the truth, we certainly are going to be handicapped in pursuing justice. So that's my invitation. That's my suggestion. I hope you'll pursue it. It would also be a tremendous benefit to scholars, because scholars has no funds, no budget, no income, other than from, you know, items like this. So you'll be helping to promote additional research in 9/11 and also spreading the truth, information, evidence relevant to determining the truth. So what's going on politically? Well, a lot of oddities. Last week, Ed Schultz, of all people, is promoting Hillary to be Barack's vice presidential candidate. This is, in my opinion, absurd on its face for all kinds of reasons. I tried to call in to say that I now get it. The Ed Schultz theory of change is that you begin with Bush as president, and then Clinton as president, Bush as president, and then Clinton as vice president. I mean, how could Barack Obama represent a new broom sweeping clean, a new way, change in Washington, if you bring back Hillary and all of her baggage? And that includes Bill and Monica and Whitewater and Vince Foster, and don't think the Republicans aren't salivating over the idea. So I couldn't believe that Ed Schultz was even offering that opinion, but he was doing so with great enthusiasm. Okay. So it looks as though Hillary, who's going to be speaking on the second day, clearly won't be the choice, and she shouldn't be. I believe the best possible choice for Obama would be Bill Richardson. He needs somebody who represents a very progressive approach, somebody who could is very much aligned with him. Richardson represents a great deal of experience with diplomacy, with administration, with Washington. He's the guy who negotiated the settlement with the North Koreans. He's a brilliant guy, and he represents Hispanics. Great choice. So I'm reading an article now here in the Wisconsin State Journal for Monday, and it says McCain games ground on Obama, and it says that now they're running neck and neck, dead even. And I say to myself, well, what's wrong with this picture? Okay, we know that everyone hates Bush. We know that everyone wants change. We know 65% of the American people think this country is headed in the wrong direction. Now, on the one hand, we have this young, a brilliant, articulate candidate as a representative of change. On the other hand, we have this old, senile, incoherent representative of the status quo. And you're going to tell me that they're running neck and neck, especially after Obama goes to Europe with a stunning triumphal visit to the Middle East and to Europe and to Berlin. Fantastic, wonderful, sensational. It wasn't that long ago, if you think back upon it, that Obama was running a 15-point lead, and that was before he made his visits to the Middle East. If there were honest polling today, I would project that Obama would be leading by something like 57-32. So what is going on? In my opinion, there's a deliberate skewing of the polls, which can be easily done. For example, just by excluding everyone who uses cell phones, right? Cell phones are expensive for pollers to contact, so they'll just do it without exclude the cell phone users, who are, I would conjecture, overwhelmingly favorable to Obama, and ask very leading questions to artificially suppress the vote so it looks as though it's very close. This has multiple benefits. One is that, you know, it reduces or tempers enthusiasm by the Obama maniacs, right? It makes it look as though Obama's doing something wrong, and therefore you get the internal criticism inside the campaign trying to figure out what they should do right, and they may make stupid mistakes like modifying Obama's position on offshore drilling, for example. When these companies already have tons and tons, thousands of leases they're not using, and offshore drilling isn't going to help Americans with their oil prices at all. All that oil goes on the international market. So that you have McCain just lying to the American people, saying it's going to help our oil prices next year. That's absurd. Wouldn't make any difference for 10 years, and then only indirectly, because that oil goes on the international market. It doesn't come into the United States, even if it's drilled out of the United States and its continental shelf. So McCain's just lying through his teeth, and he's become a pathetic caricature of a straight-talking anything. This guy is a disgusting cretin of the status quo. And in the third place, then, of course, it can set up the theft of the election using electronic voting machines, which has been the plan all along. If it looks like the election is very close, you see, because we've been induced into that by this constant bombardment by polls that are actually inaccurate, grossly inaccurate, if I am right, then they can steal the election using electronic voting machines, and it won't be very conspicuous. Now, I'm going to have an expert on voting and polling on the program on Thursday, Bob Fitrakis. And Bob knows a great deal about what's going on here, and I want you to tune in and listen, because I think you're going to be dismayed. Now, there are other stupid things going on here, including I recently got an email from the LaRouche organization. I've been open-minded about LaRouche. I've had a number of members of that group appear on this program in the past. And here I get one entitled, Washington Sources Confirm That Barack Obama is Clinically Insane. I couldn't believe this. I could not believe this. Absolutely stunning stuff. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. On Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. I think we all need help because there's so many lies being dished out these days. I mean, this thing from the LaRouche organization is only the most egregious. Listen to this. High-level sources in and around Washington, D.C. have confirmed the story implied by articles appearing in today's Washington Post and New York Times that putative Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama is clinically insane. Quote, Barack Obama has gone from being the presumptive nominee, now he's becoming the presumptuous nominee. Dana Milbank wrote in a scathing piece in the Washington Post that ridicules Obama's arrogance, megalomania, and paranoia. He traveled in a bubble more insulating than the actual president's traffic that was shut down for him. His schedule for the day announced Monday night he'd have a would have made Dick Cheney envious. 11 a.m. en route to be announced, 12.05 p.m. en route to be announced, 1.45 en route to be announced, 2.55 en route to be announced, 5.20 en route to be announced. This article pointedly notes Obama's biggest challenge may not be Republican John McCain, but his own hubris. Should be noted, the alleged hubris Milbank refused who is not Obama's own, but that of the puppet makers who have deployed him. See, this is not even a coherent further claiming, oh, there's something wrong with Obama, but now it's his handlers. This is absurd. Obama needs to keep his schedule private because he's a candidate for assassination. I was asked a long time ago, what's the prospect of him being assassinated? I said 10%, and it increases as he gets more and more successful. I rated over 50%. They've got to keep his schedule tight. The Secret Service, it was already this funny business with a plane that was borrowed from the Hillary campaign. And he's got to have somebody who would be good and wonderful and strong to pursue his policies if anything happened to him. It would be a huge blunder if Obama chooses one of these meaningless non-entities out of a concern not to do any damage. This guy is all too likely to succeed him. Then we got a similar thing from Maureen Dowd of the New York Times, who says, you know, about Obama's hubris. This is all completely ridiculous. Maureen Dowd should know better. Dana Milbank I've seen many times on Keith Olbermann's. And now I used to think he was a good guy, and now I despise him. This is all rubbish. This is completely incompetent. Anyone who's familiar with human beings, with men, I spent 4 years at Princeton, all male, 4 years in the Marine Corps, overwhelmingly male. I've had thousands and thousands of students over 35 years of teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning. There is absolutely nothing wrong with Barack Obama's state of mental health, in my opinion. He is perfectly normal, rational, competent. He's brilliant. And if he says something like, you know, he doesn't want to fly too close to the sun, that's a classic literary illusion. That you shouldn't, you know, become too infatuated with yourself. That displays humility. And to suggest he's clinically insane, that's a medical judgment. That requires a clinical psychologist or a psychiatrist. Dana Milbank and Maureen Dowd, to the best of my knowledge, are not psychologists, clinical psychologists or psychiatrists. This is absurd. I got so furious about this, I called the LaRouche people and gave him a piece of my mind. This is completely outrageous. I told him to take me off their list. This is completely ridiculous. Well, it's only part and parcel kind of rubbish. Look, William Colby told us the CIO and everyone of significance in the mass media. And if you read something that's so grossly discrepant that doesn't even pass the smell test like this, you've got to suspect that this may be some of the people he's talking about. And I say here, to my disappointment, Dana Milbank. Dana Milbank. Completely untrustworthy. Dana Milbank. Maureen Dowd, I've admired her forever. I don't know what to make of Maureen Dowd. She just has said something here much more. Seems to me they're seeking to exaggerate here. But this isn't all. Get this. Here's some examples and something you ought to check out if you don't already know. Citizens for Legitimate Government. Al-Qaeda expert re-killed by CIA by Lori Price, 30 July. It's Groundhog Day at the CIA. Abu Kabab al-Masari died in January 2006 and again on Monday. Once again, the mainstream media announced the re-killing of another key Al-Qaeda operative by a CIA-operated piloted drone. These top CIA Al-Qaeda operatives and their subsequent deaths are more bountiful than poppy fields in Afghanistan or oil smuggling routes in Iraq. Here's another one. On the 31st, exclusive to provoke war, Cheney considered proposal to dress up Navy SEALs as Iranians and shoot at them. Speaking at the Campus Progressive Journalism Conference earlier this month, Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New Yorker, revealed that Bush administration officials held a meeting recently in the vice president's office to discuss ways to provoke war with Iran. Hersh said there were a dozen ideas proffered about how to trigger a war. The one that interested me the most was, why don't we build in our shipyard four or five boats that look like Iranian PT boats, put Navy SEALs on them with lots of arms, and next time one of our boats goes to the Strait of Hormuz, start a shoot-up. Might cost some lives. It was rejected because you can't have Americans killing Americans. Oh, right. They don't reject it because Americans shouldn't kill Americans. Look what happened on 9/11. These people don't care about killing Americans. Get this, the FBI, here's another headline. The FBI was told to blame anthrax scare on Al-Qaeda by White House officials. This is dated August 2nd. In the immediate aftermath of the 2001 anthrax attacks, White House officials repeatedly pressed FBI Director Robert Mueller to prove it was a second wave assault by Al-Qaeda, but investigators ruled that out. After the October 5, 2001 death from anthrax exposure of Sun photo editor Robert Stevens, Mueller was beaten up during Bush's morning intelligence briefing for not producing proof the killer sports were the handiwork of terrorist mastermind Osama bin Laden. They really wanted to blame it on someone in the Middle East, the retired FBI official told the news. Of course, this was weapons-grade anthrax. It was very rapidly determined to come from Fort Detrick, Maryland. This is not something you could cook up in the cave in Afghanistan. The whole thing's absurd, but we're getting the impression of how much fakery, lies, deceit, and deception we are bombarded with from this administration. Here's another one. Book says White House ordered forgery. This is just August 5th, which, if the calendar is correct, is today. A new book by the author Ron Suskind claims the White House ordered the CIA to forge a backdated handwritten letter from the head of Iraqi intelligence to Saddam Hussein. Suskind writes in The Way of the World to be published Tuesday that the alleged forgery, adamantly denied by the White House, was designed to portray a false link between Hussein's regime and Al-Qaeda as a justification for the Iraq war. The author also claims the Bush administration had information from a top Iraqi intelligence official that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, intelligence they received in plenty of time to stop an invasion. This was all done, and we have the reports how the George Tenet went back to the CIA and said, you're not going to like this, but here's what we're being asked to do. And he did it. And he did it. And they did it. The whole thing. Smoke, mirrors, lies. Anyone who thinks they wouldn't stoop to special effects and about 9/11 just doesn't understand this administration. This is the Karl Rove playbook of creating your own reality. It's all fraudulent. And get this, this is absolutely stunning. Pentagon study, this is just dated the 31st, Thursday. Pentagon study says Bush's war on terror off target. Study calls for fundamental rethinking of U.S. strategy to focus on minimizing overt military action and increasing intelligence collection and partnership with law enforcement agencies around the world. A Pentagon Commission study published Wednesday said the Bush administration's seven-year-old war on terror is off target. The report done by RAND Corporation under a Pentagon Commission said the current strategy for defeating al-Qaeda has not been successful and is unlikely to do better without a shift in emphasis. It said since 2001, al-Qaeda has conducted a greater number of attacks across a larger geographic area than at any time in its history. Now, this, of course, was the Bush had claimed that the Clinton approach, which was a law enforcement and intelligence investigative approach, was not the right approach, and we needed a more muscular foreign policy and to go after them militarily. Here, by the way, any of you who read the New York Times, there's a wonderful book review on August 3rd of a book called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. You ought to read it. Here are a couple of key parts. Talking about the use of terrorism, torture, for example. This vast regime of pain and terror inflicted in the name of war on terror rests in large part on the untested belief of few high-ranking leaders in Washington that torture is an effective tool for eliciting valuable information. But there is, Mayer pervasively argues, little available evidence that this assumption is true, a great deal suggesting it's false. In fact, it's one of the least effective methods of gathering information and a likely source of false confessions. But you see, I would point out, that's exactly what they wanted. They had to use torture to extract false confessions to support a phony war on terror. There were no true confessions because the terrorists they claimed existed did not. It's truly unbelievable what the United States has descended into, a cesspool of lies and deceit and deception and death. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Thank you for listening.